Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, everyone. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of CFRI, the Cystic Fibrosis Research Institute, and I welcome you to what promises to be an extremely interesting podcast with Dr. David Weil, a physician, former director of the Stanford Lung Transplant Program, and published author. As always, before we get started, I must note the information and insights shared during this recording should not be used for medical advice, diagnosis, nor treatment, and please consult with your physician before making any changes to your health maintenance plan. We thank our sponsors whose support has made this webinar possible: Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesi USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Viatris. So let's get started with the program. I am here with Dr. David Weil, who spent over 20 years as a transplant physician, 10 of which were spent directing Stanford's Center for Advanced Lung Disease and the Lung Transplant Program at Stanford. As you'll hear from Dr. Weil, during these years, he experienced the highest professional highs, I would say, and also some of the lowest of the lows. He left Stanford in 2016 to return to his native New Orleans, where he founded Weil Consulting Group, which is focused on improving the delivery of transplant care. Dr. Weil's book, Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant, is an incredibly personal memoir of his years in transplant. I'm sure many watching today have read the book, and for those who have not, you really, really must. It touches upon aspects of transplant from many levels, from the broader macro view of medical bureaucracy to the intensely personal stories of his patients and his own sense of responsibility for their lives as well as for their deaths. We are honored that Dr. Weil is here to talk about his journey, share a reading from his book, and answer the many questions I'm sure we all have. And a quick note, if you do have questions for Dr. Weil, please use the Q&A box, not the chat box, and we will try to get to as many as we can today. And with that, I welcome Dr. Weil to take the mic. Welcome.
Thank you, Siri. And I really appreciate being here tonight. This is a homecoming of sort, I feel like, with the CFRI. So I really, really do appreciate it. As Siri mentioned, I have written about my experiences at Stanford and before I got to Stanford. And I want to play, first off, just a small 2-minute video that explains a little bit about the book, if you'll allow me.
My name is David Weil. I'm a transplant doctor, and I wrote a book called Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. It's a behind-the-scenes look of the emotional ups and downs of a transplant program, both from a patient's perspective and from a physician's. Early on in my career, my father developed liver disease that required a transplant. So after being the doctor, I was now being the family member. Having to see it from that side really changed my perspective about the entire field. I went through the waiting list period with him, the operation and the post-operative recovery. After that point, everything about the field for me changed. What I don't think people understand is what's going on inside of the mind of the person that's trying to deliver that kind of care. In doing lung transplants, we had both great successes and also devastating failures. As head of the transplant program at Stanford, I handled that huge responsibility and sometimes wore it well and sometimes didn't wear it as well. I think that I have been able to tell these patient stories, and in doing so, I reveal a lot about them, but I also reveal a lot about me as somebody that's delivering that kind of care. One thing that I write toward the end of the book that I think will be interesting to readers of all kinds is, how do you develop a life that has balance to it? And balance looks different for different people. So I'm hopeful that someone picks up my book who's first starting out in their career, no matter what it is, and looks at my example as not something to avoid entirely, but a cautionary tale about what can happen if you get too tightly wrapped up in what you're doing.
Thank Thank you, and thanks for allowing me to play that. It gives a great overview of the book. And as Siri mentioned at the beginning, when I left Stanford in 2016, I had quite a bit on my mind, and I thought that the best way to sort through all these different kinds of emotions was to write it down. I kept a journal during the times that I was working in the hospital, and those journal entries became the basis of my book. I want to read two passages from my book for you that I think bookend my career well. When I was a younger physician just entering the transplant field, I was amazed at the mystique of it, and it was magical to me. It was almost a religion, and I'll tell one of those stories that does come from earlier on in my career, and this is directly from my book. The quiet of the morning, just before the nurses change shifts. The day nurses haven't come in yet, and the night nurses are too exhausted to move or speak. Patients' families are asleep in the waiting room. Except for me, the older doctors, the ones out of their residency, aren't there yet. The only sound that registers barely is the rhythmic sound of the mechanical ventilator delivering breath to the new lungs, interrupted only by the occasional sound of a monitor in the distance. I'm sitting in a chair by a patient's bedside, a young woman named Cindy with cystic fibrosis who received a double lung transplant several hours ago. Just days earlier, near her end, she had been dying a suffocating death, trying to breathe while coughing up cups full of infected sputum. The call about the organ donor had woken me up in the middle of the night, just like so many times before. It meant that Cindy could come off the waiting list. She went to the operating room, and then after the procedure, was wheeled back to the ICU where I was waiting for her. She is now moving slightly, trying to clear the sedative and anesthetic medications from her system. The lungs are working perfectly, just as I had hoped when I accepted them for her the night before. Alone with a patient, without the background chatter from the staff, this was always my favorite time in the hospital, or maybe I should just say my favorite time, period. The nurse asked me if I can watch the patient while she grabs a cup of coffee in the break room. I say, sure. But inside I'm screaming, go, leave me alone. This is the best part. The nurse makes a beeline out of the room. My eyes follow her to make sure she's gone. Now it gets better. Cindy is waking up, eyes searching the ceiling, shaking her head slowly, coughing a silent cough around the endotracheal tube. I stand up and lean over her in the bed, coming into her field of vision from out of nowhere, it must seem. I smile at her, and her eyes sparkle. I tell her that we'll get the tube out soon, that the transplant was a success, that she's a rock star, that I'm so proud of her. Her eyes start to fill with tears. Mine do too. I can't possibly imagine a better feeling, a rush you can't get from any pharmacy or off the street from a dealer or at a local bar. No, this is different. And I thought in that moment, I could do this again and again, watch a patient wake up from a successful transplant over and over, and no one would ever tell me to stop. So that's from the beginning part of my book. And as you see, if you read the book, there's going to be a roller coaster. There's ups and there's downs, great successes, and then patients that we lost as well that were devastating to me. And toward the end of my time at Stanford, I tell a story in the book about a woman that I call Tina Dahlgren. Her nickname was Dr. D. She received a double lung transplant for cystic fibrosis, and she had done great. She was 8 years post-transplant and had wonderful stories to tell me. She climbed mountains. She rode her bike. She jumped out of an airplane, much to my chagrin. I was very fond of her. She and I had a close relationship. I would walk into the clinic room, and I can still see her now, with her feet up on the desk, looking at the computer, trying to look up her own labs. And unfortunately, she was also looking up the labs of some of her friends, which violated 7 or 8 hospital policies at a time. But nonetheless, Tina and I became very close. She ultimately developed a complication that some of you may be familiar with called chronic rejection, and ultimately needed a second transplant. And this is where I pick up the story about Tina from my book. I had subconsciously decided that if I said Tina was still eligible for a transplant, then she was. And if she was, we could still save her. It was time to have a discussion with her family about the details of the end of her life, but instead, I'd spent my time scrambling to get her relisted for another transplant and assuring her parents that things were going to work out, that I had everything under control. I'd known it was a long shot, and as I sat there in the ICU watching Tina die slowly from respiratory failure, it was clear that we would not find her donor lungs in time. Technically, she was still on the waiting list, but she was far too sick for that now. It was time for me to say goodbye. Even with heavy sedation, the effects of pneumonia were obvious. The futility of our efforts hit me with the force of a car crash. I tried to think of another way to save her, anything else that I could try. "Come on, David," I could hear Tina say in my head, "do something." "Doesn't it look like I'm trying?" I replied to the voice. "I'm not God." I found my internal monologue was simultaneously explaining my position and begging for her forgiveness. "Not God. That's pretty clear." I could almost hear Tina's high-pitched, nearly maniacal laugh, and imagined her red hair flying as her body convulsed hysterically. I smiled. "Tina, you're killing me. You and all the others just like you." I stood up and went to her bedside. Her eyes were closed, her chest moving up and down with the ventilator cycles. I touched her face and it felt cool. Not as cold as a dead person, but not as warm as someone fully alive either. I put my hand on her forehead and then over her eyes and held it there for a moment. I leaned over and kissed her forehead. "Dr. D," I said so softly that even the nurse couldn't hear me. Tears came to my eyes. "Sorry," I said. I needed to leave before I lost it. It was time to go talk to her parents. After talking with the family, there was an all too familiar exchange of pleasantries. "I really like Tina," I said, and they responded, "Dr. Weil, she really appreciated all you did for her. The relationship you two had was special." I called our nurse and told her to take Tina off the waiting list. It was the official end of Tina's rope, and I was the one who had to cut her lifeline. It was time to face the fact, though, that she was too far gone. It was also time for me to face some facts about my career. Continuing to do this work the way I was doing it was not sustainable. I needed to get off the merry-go-round. I just didn't know how. I didn't think I could stop myself. Transplant was my duty, my responsibility, and what I was trained and programmed to do. It was hard to imagine leaving my post, but I needed to find a graceful exit, an elegant off-ramp that would satisfy my need for a tidy conclusion. One way or another, I wanted off the roller coaster so I could never again be crushed by a patient like Tina. That had been my life for nearly 20 years. That was enough. For me, the job was no longer a pure and simple exercise in rationality. I had mastered the mechanics of being a transplant doctor. That was the easy part. But now, from an emotional standpoint, every wife was my wife, every child was my child, and every father was my father, and I needed to save them all. So I think that those two different passages gives you some flavor for the what attracted me and people like me to the field in the first place, and then ultimately, what are some of the reasons that the field really does beat somebody up? And we've read a lot about all of this lately in terms of the COVID crisis and the effect it's had on healthcare workers. But this has been going on in medicine for a long time. And much of what I write about in the book is not only what I went through, but also what patients go through and their families go through when they get this kind of therapy. So again, thank you for allowing me to read those two passages. And I think Siri is going to come on and we'll talk a little bit.
Yes, we will. So much to talk about. And thank you so much for sharing your readings. And again, I have to say to everybody, this book, it moved me to tears. And it's a complex book because it is big picture, but down to your very, very personal story. So I have been thinking about questions that I wanted to ask you, and you know, some are big picture and some are more personal, but so let's start with personal. and you know, it seems like it would be a no-brainer to address mental health issues among clinicians, especially people in your role. But as you share in the book, there's this culture of stoicism, right? The, you know, suck it up, be strong, be the leader, be the alpha, whether male or female. So there's a reluctance to admit that help or mental health support may be needed. So what was the point for you where you shifted and realized it was time to reach out for help? And what would you say to other clinicians who are facing the same burnout and stress and anxiety?
Yeah, so I'm giving a lot of medical center talks as part of my book launch. And the message that I'm giving to medical centers is that we've got to destigmatize what we feel and our interest in sharing them, those kind of emotions. And we've also got to destigmatize therapy. We've got to just decide that therapy is an incredibly huge part of life. I think a lot of us, and the analogy I use, go to the gym or try to exercise every day. I look at it as much the same. Instead of working out my body, I'm working out my mind. When I was going through this, I think that there was, for me, a loss of focus on the many, many successes we had in our program. And there were lots, not only at the time that I was at Stanford, but at the times before that. Instead, I was focusing on the failures or the outcomes that I wasn't very happy with. And I think that loss of perspective signaled to me that it was time for me to step away, because the reason that I was so attracted to the field in the first place is because of all the many successes that we had had. And so that was a signal to me.
And staying in that vein, we have some questions for you from Dr. Lisa Scher, who really acknowledges the highs and lows that you would feel and how hard that would be, especially as a provider. You feel it's your personal responsibility to save a patient's life. It says, let's see, failure when they die. Of course, transplant is an extreme medicine with very sick patients. Do you think the way medicine views death and pathologizes it, I'm so sorry if I mispronounced that, and the fact that physicians do not have enough training to think and process and talk about death contributes to physician burnout?
Hi, Lisa. And I definitely do. I think that it's a big, big problem. When I was training in medicine, my early medical mentors, as you suggested, I think in your question, were, you know, taught us basically to suck it up, to tough it out, that it didn't really matter how we felt. We were there to serve the patient, which I think is partially true. We are there to serve the patient. But in order to do that, we've got to remain healthy ourselves. So I think that at least physicians of my generation are not taught at all about how to take care of ourselves. And I think, as the question suggested, I think it's a huge problem. I see some shift in it, though. And the only silver lining of the COVID crisis has been that many of the hospitals that I work with now have put in place programs to help the providers with their emotional well-being. And I see all kinds of positive changes across the country, really, in the hospitals that I work with that I think are positive and may last well beyond the pandemic.
Well, you comment in the book how you had gone back to Stanford 2 years later for a course and how you were so impressed. There was a whole position now to deal with wellness, right? And what do you think is the trigger for Stanford and just nationwide this trend you're seeing?
Well, it was interesting. I did go back to Stanford. This was before the pandemic, but after I had left, and there was now a dean's position level person in charge of physician wellness. And I think that was very forward looking of Stanford to do. I think that the research has been very clear on this matter for some years, but I think particularly in academic medical centers, there hadn't been programs put in place that I think would really address the issue. So I think Stanford was very forward looking in that way. I think that there's going to be a jump start to all of this with the pandemic. And I think that there's going to be, and this is in the lay press quite a bit, about the extreme situations that doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers have been working on during the pandemic. But I would just tell the listeners that this is not a new problem. I think the pandemic made it an acute problem, but this has been going on for some time. And those in that work in the transplant field were susceptible to it, as was I, because of the high stakes nature of it. Even though I intellectually understood that some of the patients that I treated might not make it, I was unable to accept that. And I thought somewhat arrogantly that I could control all the outcomes. And I think that ended up being a revelation that I'm not in control of all of the outcomes. And I realized that late in my career.
And Dr. Scher, I'm going to swing to your question in just a second, but I want to stay with the issue of what has come from COVID. And another thing that, of course, was laid bare, something we all knew but is now very overt, are the incredible disparities in healthcare. And you talk about, especially in transplant, how challenging it is. There's quantitative data, but there's so much qualitative information. And you talk about people's lives being decided around a conference table during those meetings. And you also make a reference to race, class, absolutely, even intellectual disabilities, as in the case of, I think it was Brian, that these all come into play. And so, in light of this greater awareness, do you think there are ways to put in place better measures as these decisions will be made, with all we know about implicit internal bias, et cetera?
Yeah, I do. And I think that, the COVID crisis has highlighted racial disparities in healthcare, but that's also not a new problem. There's been around three decades of research, highlighting those disparities. They're present in transplant, and our group at Stanford wrote about some of the disparities in transplant medicine while I was there. But they're present in literally every aspect of medicine. And in fact, I'm working on a second book right now, and part of that book will be focusing on the racial disparities, not in and of themselves so much, but emblematic of how American medicine has lost its soul in many ways, because we have studied this issue, racial disparities, for over 30 years and have not addressed it. And in fact, there's pretty good information that it's getting worse. And I think that we can't consider ourselves, a moral and ethical field if we don't address those. And I think that there's going to be a lot of talk about how exactly to do that. But I'm afraid a lot of it boils down to is narrowing the wealth gap. Not so much the income gap, but the wealth gap.
And another question for Dr. Scher. And in the book, you refer to the sense of it's like being God, right? This power to save lives. So she says, also, it seems that there was an evolution for you from being God to finding God. And if you'd want to comment on the role faith has played for you.
Yeah, faith has played a big role in what I consider my evolution. I think that I grew up without a religious background. I write in the book that my mother was from Selma, Alabama, and Southern Baptist. And my father had immigrated from Germany. He was Jewish and immigrated here in 1939. Neither one of them practiced their religion. As children, we didn't really have any formal religion in our lives. And as I went through various struggles, you know, as I got into my 40s and then into my 50s, I realized that part of me was missing. And I married a wonderful woman who is Catholic. My children were baptized, and I was running off to the hospital on Sundays while they were going to church every Sunday. And I felt disconnected from them. And so for all of those reasons, I sought out a more formal religion in my life, and Catholicism appealed to me from a number of different standpoints. So I became Catholic almost 10 years ago.
I have to say, anybody reads the book, we all love your wife and your kids.
Me too.
They have been quite the supporters for you. It just seemed like just lovely people. So, yeah. And I must say, there's a wonderful, I love in the book, we're talking about faith, when you and your sisters are called for independent meetings with your parents, and you don't know if you're in trouble or not. And then you go in, and what did your father ask you?
Is that, you know, my father, German, very precise, very disciplined. Everything was a family meeting when he wanted to talk with us. So he sat us down individually and said, so do you want to go to services on Saturday or Sunday? And I was, you know, I was 9 years old. I had no idea. And I said, if it means that I can play more basketball, then I don't want to go at all. And so we ended up, they basically asked each one of us, and each one of us had the same answer. So off we went.
And could you talk more about your father? Because he obviously played such a key role in so many aspects of your life and even your evolution of mental health and reaching out. So I'd love if you talk more about that.
Yeah, my father and I had a close relationship. He, as I mentioned, you know, grew up very differently than I did, having to come to this country without speaking the language, and came here and became an overwhelming professional success. He was a pulmonologist. He was internationally known. He had all the usual accolades that go along with that. And he and I were close. He was a very driven man. He motivated me. Some would say motivated me too much. And part of, you know, what I went through, as many sons do with their fathers, they wanted his approval. They wanted their father's approval. They wanted to impress them. And I was not particularly destined for success in high school. I had other things on my mind that I write about in the book. And he basically sat me down before I went to college and said, you know, it's time to get your act together. And he said it pretty forcefully, and I did. And it was when he needed a transplant early on in my career, as I mentioned in the book trailer, that everything changed for me. You know, now instead of it, it's just somebody's father, and that was my father. And I was sitting in the waiting room with him, and I was sitting with him the night that he went into transplant surgery, not knowing if he was going to come out of it or not. And he did, you know, beautifully well. Even at age 68, when he got his transplant, he lived for another 12 years and did well. But it wed me to the field in a way that I don't think I can describe. It made it not just a job, it made it a mission. And it changed for me that night that he got transplanted. And I think that, you know, patients sometimes probably think that we as physicians don't really know what they're going through. And I think in some cases that's right. But I had a better understanding of what it's like to be wheeled to surgery, you know, not knowing how it was going to shake out. And that was a really profound experience for me. And then losing him ultimately in 2013, in the midst of my own career angst at that point, was a kind of a perfect storm in a lot of ways. He was my, guiding light in so many ways. And losing him and then becoming disillusioned with my own professional career, which I care deeply about, was a kind of a double whammy that I think really required my stepping out.
Finding my mute button. I love the scene, the story you shared when he was being wheeled off and he says to you, like, well, is there anything else you need to ask me? Like, if things don't turn out, and how you handled that. I think that to me summed up a lot of why it was very hard for you to actually admit, you know, things are hard and I need to talk and I need help just based on that. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, I mean, he did ask me that question and, you know, is there anything that you need to know from me? And I said, no, I'm good. And, you know, you know, it indicated just the mindset, you know, that I had. I was very self-reliant. I was self-assured. I think anybody that worked with me would agree with that. But then in losing him in 2013, I also had, and I can still remember like it was yesterday, standing actually at his bedside when he passed away. And I had a lot of difficulty conjuring up any emotion at that point. And that concerned me. I knew that that was not normal and that was probably not very human. And that concerned me quite a bit. And that was the beginning of a process that led me to re-examine so much about my own life is when he passed away in 2013.
Knowing that this book is based on those 10 years mainly at Stanford, I'm curious, I'm sure I'm asking this on behalf of lots of people. How did you go about changing names, identifiers, et cetera, to convey the actuality of the story, but to protect people?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, when I sat down to write the book, my goal was not to harm anybody by writing the book. If anything, I was probably harder on myself in the book than anybody else. And my editor pointed that out to me quite a bit. The patient confidentiality was extremely important to me. I did everything I could to not only change the names, but change the appearance, change the circumstance, change the disease in some states, in some instances. And then with the people with whom I worked at Stanford, I also didn't want to harm them in any way and wanted to protect their own privacy and integrity and change their names, appearances, the titles that they held at Stanford were changed. And I did that recognizing that I still had to tell the story and I had to involve people that were part of that story, but I wanted to make sure that changing those names and appearances would protect them.
You talk about how you have had a box in your office of letters and cards and such. Do you still have contact with many of your patients, former patients, and their families?
A lot, a lot. Besides just email and text messages in the usual ways, one good thing has been social media. I know that there's some bad parts about social media, but it's been a wonderful way for me to keep in touch with patients over a 25-year career. And it really sustains me, especially now, because I'm not on the front lines of you know, hospital work anymore. And to hear from patients about what's going on in their lives, from their family members, and reminding me, and I need reminding of this, about all the good that I was a part of. And, you know, the box that I describe in the book was a physical reminder of all of it, the pictures and the letters and the thank you notes and, you know, the photographs of people skiing, hiking, playing golf, wedding anniversary notices, you know, all of it just formed a tapestry for my transplant life. And, you know, in that box, and I write about this in the book, is my transplant life. That's what it was for me. And no matter what, that's always going to be there for me. And I think that that's nourishing, because at this stage of the game, and especially after writing a book about all of this, I spent a lot of time reflecting and looking back. But part of that look back is going to be to have all of those wonderful messages. People say the nicest things.
Which is good, because you are extraordinarily hard on yourself in the book. I've heard a lot of people who have had transplants say, it's interesting, it's almost like they own me. Like the transplant clinic owns me.
Yeah.
And I already had heard that from several people, but there's a story about patient Ken, who in the book, he's having a hard time with ventilation. He's kind of given up. He says he wants to die. And you just went on in and yelled at him that he was not going to waste the transplant and dishonor the donor's family. And so I'm just curious for you, do you feel the sense of ownership? I know it seems an odd word.
Yeah.
Those lungs you transplant?
This is true in medicine in general, and this is generational, but there's a very patriarchal relationship traditionally between especially male physicians, I might add, and their patients. I think that it's to the nth degree in transplantation. The team invests an enormous amount of emotional resources, programmatic resources to get people transplanted. And I definitely think, and I have heard my colleagues say it, that they feel that the patient has a responsibility to them and not the other way around. And I probably had a little bit less of that than some, because, you know, I also believe that people should lead their lives the way they want to. And but nonetheless, I was heavily invested in the outcomes of our patients for a variety of reasons, mainly because I needed them to do well, you know, in a spiritual sense. And for instance, in the story I tell about Ken, I thought that yelling at him, showing tough love, as it were, was the best way to get him out of the hospital. Now, in that case, it worked. I'm not saying it works in every case, but in that case, it worked. And actually, it was a funny story. I heard from the person that I called Ken a couple of weeks ago and his wife, and they loved it. They loved the story. They loved the whole thing. We had a great conversation about that whole incident.
That's great. I love that. We have a question from Luann. What is the role of therapy for all of us as patients who have gone through transplant, as families who endure the trauma of the wait, and as healthcare workers? And thank you forever, Dr. Weil, for your loving service.
Yeah. Hi, Luann. You know, I think therapy is all about transparency. It's about, you know, shining light. And there's no magic answers in therapy for patients, for providers, for any of us. All they do, as best I can tell, at least my own experience, all it does is make you say what you think out loud. And then I think when you say it out loud, it either sounds rational or it doesn't sound particularly rational. And it helps you kind of sort through that, I think, by saying it out loud. I, as most people that have been in therapy, do most of the talking. And I think my experience with it has been that there's not these huge revelations, but that over time, there's just this light that gets sort of shown on what it is that you're thinking. I spent much of my career trying not to say what I was thinking, not to my wife, not to my kids, not to my colleagues, certainly, and not to my patients. I mean, I spent a lot of effort on that. And then things changed, and I spent a lot of effort making sure I said all of what was on my mind, and part of that resulted in a book, because that's pretty much all of what was on my mind at that point.
And fortunately, you found a provider who was able to see through your use of humor as a deflection.
Yes.
Question from Bonnie. My favorite transplant doctor from UCLA left as well, and I'm wondering how the institutions can be retrained to keep a compassionate and committed doctor involved without all of the university overhead.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I work with transplant programs across the country now that are having various struggles, and one of the biggest struggles they have is losing their people, and it's a huge problem. Not only are not enough young physicians entering the field at all, because they see some of us having ups and downs with it, but there's a retention problem within the transplant industry itself, getting people to stay in it. And then a third and final problem is getting people to stay at any one institution. People, you know, transplant programs are kind of like civilizations in a lot of ways. They change over the course of the years and they evolve. And sometimes all of the people leave and a whole new set comes in. And it's almost like you have to, it's difficult work and you have to periodically shake it up. You have to bring in new people with new energy and new perspective. And I think that happens with, you know, in many transplant programs, not just the ones I've been involved in, but in many of them.
Elise asks, how can we as patients help physicians to ease their emotional burden, yet also connect on that level?
That's a great question. I don't think it should be the responsibility of the patients to do that. I think patients do their part. I write about this in the book, was on the receiving end of a ridiculous amount of gratitude during the course of my career. And that gratitude nourished me. I got used to it. I got a little addicted to it. But at the same time, I don't know that a patient can actually change the dynamic for a healthcare provider. You know, for me, the only thing that would have changed it would have been every patient does great and, you know, goes off to live a long life. That's not realistic. Instead, I think what the providers need to do is talk with one another about what they're experiencing. And there's very little of that in a hospital setting. It is not the culture of hospitals that I'm familiar with that, you know, if I was struggling, I share it with somebody else, or they share it with me. The tendency is just to do the opposite. And I see that in the hospitals that I work with now. It's the exact same problem. I don't think that one's getting particularly better.
And I failed to add at the end of that question that Elise Okunum-Goldberg says, thank you, Dr. Wiles. Speaking of gratitude, it is definitely still coming your way. So it sounds like you stepped away, you started your consulting company, you wrote this book, but you've actually re-entered the world of transplant. Is this true?
In a small way. I mean, not in the way I did it at Stanford. There's a local transplant hospital that is in New Orleans that has had some of my trainees at Stanford there. They've since left, unfortunately. And I work with them part-time, mainly not so much as a player on the field, but as a coach on the sidelines. So I would consider it part-time work. It complements my consulting work that I do with a number of hospitals across the country, but it's not in any way similar to the sort of position and the way I approached my job when I was at Stanford.
As part of that, there's an incredible moment for you that you describe where you're with a woman who's being evaluated. She has emphysema. Yeah. And then a man comes into the room that you're not sure the relation, and it's the recipient of this woman's son's heart. Do I have that correctly?
You got
and
that right.
Moment when you all hold hands and this connection of somebody seeking transplant, somebody who gave the gift through her son to somebody else, incredibly, incredibly moving. And it made me wonder about how much contact you had with donor families through the years.
Yeah, less and less, unfortunately, as time went on. And when I started out in the transplant field, I was the one with the waiting list in my pocket full of names. And I would actually interact with the donor families. There's much more of a separation now, and probably appropriately so, as time goes on, so that there's no conflict of interest, really. You know, I've got somebody I want to transplant, so why don't you donate their organs? And there's guilt tripping and all kind of stuff going on. But I in my capacity as an ICU doctor, when I was earlier in my career, I had a lot of interaction with donor families, and it's an amazing thing to do. I mean, when you think about the trauma that those folks are experiencing, and then somebody like me walks up to them and said, how about, you know, donating your son's organs, your mother's organs, your wife's organs. And that's why about half of the time people say no, because in that moment, they're just not able to really consent for that. I think we have to change the conversation, and we have to make sure that people consider organ donation well before they experience any kind of trauma that would make them an organ donor. We all have to tell the people around us that we want to be an organ donor. We have to tell the DMV that we want to be an organ donor. And we have to have that conversation earlier, well before it's really needed. And that's how we'll get up consent rates. I also think parenthetically that there's a real socioeconomic and racial disparity with regard to organ donation. And that's African-American patients being less likely to donate than Caucasian ones. And I think that that's all about lack of trust. And I think that that lack of trust permeates our system. And it also is prevalent in the organ donation process as well.
I kind of wish that, you know, the way so much is built into high school curriculums, that they would build in a component on organ donation, just so people do think about it in advance. And, you know, I do wonder what you think about nations where they have the opt-out version of organ donation versus our system of opting in.
I like it. I like it a lot. I've studied those other systems, and there's some states in America that are kind of playing with that, because it'll probably be a state-by-state thing, unfortunately. But there are some states looking at that, and I've worked with a couple to develop those policies. It's going to be tough here. Americans culturally, I think, want to make their own choices, and they want to be able to do that in real time. An opt-out system, I think, is very attractive from a number of different standpoints, but I do have concerns that the American psychology around it, some of which we saw in the COVID crisis, won't lend itself well to that.
Exactly what I was thinking. Look at the vaccines right now in the situation. Yes, but you're not culturally equipped.
That's right.
So we're getting towards the end of our time. So I wanted to, we've been peppering you with questions, but I'm wondering if this has raised anything, any thoughts of things you would like to share in closing.
Well, the one thing that I plan on doing, and this is important, I think, to this group, but I've teamed up with a couple different, two different extraordinary people, Diane Shader-Smith, who had a daughter that passed away after a lung transplant at Pittsburgh, who read a beautiful book called Salt in My Soul, and Marianne O'Hara, who also lost a daughter after transplant in Pittsburgh. And we have three different perspectives. Me as the physician, Mallory Smith, Diane's daughter, as the patient, and Marianne O'Hara as the parent. I actually think that we ought to, and we're going to team together and actually do a number of talks. I think one with the CFRI later in the summer. But I think we need to learn more from each other. I think there's still a wall between the patient, the patient's families, and the healthcare providers. I think what we're going to try to do is interact in a way that we hope is interesting, where we actually get to say what's on our mind and what our perspectives are in various different situations that I think most patients will be able to relate to. And I think that those are the kind of things that we need to do more of. I think the humanity of medicine, and that humanity is manifested in the things that we write. And for instance, these books have talked about three different perspectives, but it's about the same thing. It's about putting the humanity back in medicine. And I desperately think that that's what we need. I think medicine, particularly in America, has lost its soul a little bit. And I think we need to get that back. And I hope working with Diane and Marianne allows us to do that.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because those who are listening, yes, they are going to present together at our conference this summer, which if you go to our website, you can register. It will be an amazing presentation on Saturday, July 31st. So that, and I'm glad that you're doing that. It's like in politics when they talk about crossing the aisle, you know.
That's right.
There are certain amazing clinicians, healthcare providers who have, who make that connection, and it is so meaningful for patients and families, and good things always happen. So thank you for helping to lead the way and push that mission along. So thank you. There are no words. This has been just a fascinating time. I've been looking forward to this. I thank everybody who joined us, those of you who are watching on Facebook Live. This is being recorded, so the good news is that if you missed any part of it or want to listen again, we'll release it next week. We thank our sponsors once again, but most especially, Dr. Weil, I thank you.
Thank you, Siri, and thanks so much to the organization for having me. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
I'm so glad. Goodbye, everybody. Be safe and be well.